any questions about the presentation from the intergovernmental agency representatives? We'll have the two questions from the members of the public after this.
Hi, George LaPointe. How do you deal with something like bats, a resident wildlife species that doesn't fit under my driveway? Call them marine mammals, although I guess you could call them marine mammals when they're flying over the ocean.
Well, certainly that would be monitored, and that effort would be processed through our AVN. We have an AVN biologist in our office who will coordinate with the different agencies during the consultation process, which will run concurrent with our legal process.
Thanks, Aldine, that was really helpful. So I want to make sure I'm clear on, is BOEM the, are you going to be in charge of the EIS, like making sure that it is written and you do the scoping sessions and then you do the hearings and publish the draft and then the final?
Yes, because we're the lead agency, we will be doing that.
So let's say, I'm just doing a little test run here, let's say that there's an unsolicited bid that comes in and you publish and there's no competitive interest and you determine there's no competitive interest. And then a SAP comes in, a site assessment plan, and you determine that there should be a NEPA review of that, that sounds like a definite, and that it should be an EIS. So then would you take the data that the applicant has submitted and share it with all of those agencies, all those federal and state agencies, or how do you actually start? I'm sort of curious about what happens that you get the data and then how do you have all of those federal agencies and state agencies look at it to form the actual EIS. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Do you want me to take that one?
Thank you.
What happens behind the curtain?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, we have a lot of tools available to us. One under NEPA that we can do and that we've done in our oil and gas program and in the sand and gravel program has actually helped are cooperating agency agreements. So, for example, let's say the avian data with regard to some migratory birds. Yes, we have an avian biologist on staff. But we know that it would be better that if we would have a cooperating agency agreement with Fish and Wildlife Service to help us do the analytics associated with evaluating the impact of that particular project to the particular species at hand. So we have cooperating agency agreements that we can work with other agencies to have a formal working relationship and understanding. So that's something we can do. We can do it with Coast Guard, Corps of Engineers, what have you. The other tool that we have, the one that we haven't used yet, is the folks around the table. This task force and helping to share the information that we gather either here or that we get from an applicant. As your example offers, Karen, that we were hoping that when they come in with their site assessment plans, we share that plan with the task force so they can understand what will be evaluated, what the applicant is proposing, as well as any other data that they file. We do have that requirement in our subpart effort plans. That for plans, that they give us any kind of information that they have, and we will share that. Also, too, hopefully, even before we get an unsolicited proposal, we have resources around the table. You know, whether it's the Fish and Wildlife Service at the federal level or your state DNR that has data with regard to ducks, another fowl and avian fish and wildlife of interest, or whether it's a recreational sort of hunting use or a protection sort of issue. We have the folks around the table who have that data that can help inform on the analysis with regard to the scenarios of the proposed actions. So we have all these tools, formal under NEPA, and I know Tim Timmerman can speak to this more eloquently than either Aldine or I. We have the cooperating agency agreements where you have that formal agreement to have the other federal entity do some work with you on a particular time frame, particularly when they're a subject matter expert. And then the other tool that we have is what we have around the table, this collective of knowledge, skill sets, and data that we can bring from the system.
Ms. McDonald, I'm the state rep. So what's confusing to a person like me is looking at all of these agencies that are involved, what standing do their findings have in the final analysis? That is, does BOEM take, would a Coast Guard finding that such and such a lease would be a hazard to navigation, would that be a showstopper, or that birds are going to be affected? What's a showstopper and what isn't? And do you get to make that evaluation in consultation with us and all these agencies? How does it work?
That is the bazillion-dollar question. I mean, that is really the crux of it. The slide that Algene has, it just shows the federal agencies, and then she has two slides that show the acts and requirements. That's what makes any kind of development in the ocean environment a challenge, because we are the lead for NEPA, and our goal there is to hope that the investment that the federal government, that you all invest in us in doing the kind of environmental analysis, can then help inform Coast Guard when they have to make their decisions, Corps of Engineers when they have to make their decisions with regard to siting and permitting, et cetera. With regard to weighing the other resource agencies, it depends. I'm going to say it depends, because if it's a statute, statutory authority under the Endangered Species Act, Migratory Bird, Marine Mammal Protection, those particular acts call out what that resource agency's responsibilities are. So in the context for that, let's say if it's a protected species under Endangered Species Act, we go through our environmental impact analysis to be able to inform us, the BOEM, using all the skills that we have around the table, using a cooperating agency agreement, we then develop what's called a biological assessment with regard to that particular critter that we want to consult with, let's say Fish and Wildlife Service. We give Fish and Wildlife Service that biological assessment. They use that then to evaluate the responsibilities that they have under Endangered Species Act for that particular critter, and then they advise us as to what sort of requirements must be required of the lessee. You saw Algene have that lease requirement, lease stipulation element. We could get a biological opinion back from this, there's no jeopardy, but these are the things you must do. These are sorts of activities that we advise you to do, et cetera. So we don't, we don't tell them how to do their business. They inform us in the context of the proposal, how the proposal could affect that particular species, if it's okay to go forward with conditions or if it is not. So then we fold that into our decision making. So that's why I said it depends. We hope to make the NEPA documentation help other agencies with their responsibilities. There are offsets of that that we call out, and we call it a biological assessment to be able to address particular species that must be consulted on. For EFH, essential fish habitat, there's usually a section in our NEPA document that calls to that point and shows that analysis if it's embedded in and calls it out. So we use the NEPA document kind of as the mother document. That's why it's important to have cooperating agency agreements and a good working relationship to make sure that's the best document it can be. So that's a multi-purpose document. But in no way do I, as BOEM, tell Fish and Wildlife Service how to come out with its biological opinion. I will give them my biological assessment that we do on that particular animal with regard to its habitat, et cetera, and then they use that as a basis to inform their decision making. So it's quite an art form, so there's no simple answer. But at the end of the day, the decision to issue a lease resides in our agency, and we have to do the balancing. But we do not, overtake their responsibilities under ESA.
Did you have a problem,
Mr.? Ron Beck from First District Coast Guard. From a timing standpoint, one of the points I wanted to make is that we try to work with harbor safety committees, port safety committees, before the draft environmental impact statement, so that we are up to speed about what the local concerns are and get our work in to BOEM before the draft environmental impact statement. And this allows for a couple of things. When the public hearings occur, that's on the table. Public comment period is available to you to come back and say, well, this really should be seen in a different way. So we're very conscious about trying to do our work as efficiently and as early as possible so that the whole public process gets supported through both the hearings, the public meetings, and the comment period.
Tim Timmerman with EPA. I want to go back to the question you asked about, I think it was a question about how you made an EIS, how you made that sausage that's an EIS. And I have a question for you, Maureen, on, since we haven't done one of these through this program, an applicant submits information that you guys use to create your EIS. You get input from agencies about whether or not we want to see more things. You gather information that we may have just based on our expertise. If there's an identification of additional work that needs to be done for establishing baseline or predicting impacts, do you have a mechanism where, instead of going back to the applicant and asking them to do a study, where you can ask them to write out a check to fund a study that you or the federal agencies are in charge of? Or is it always the mechanism that the information is provided through the applicant to you, and then you have to vet it and say, is this done the way that we would have done it?
There are several different mechanisms that we can employ. For example, I am personally familiar with one that we used for Chevron in a case associated with leasing for, it was a natural gas development and production, and this was in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, kind of similar to what we're dealing with in Maine in the sense it was frontier area and not a lot of data gathered. And so there was certain specific information that we required that was identified actually through EPA water quality that we told Chevron, working with EPA, these are the things that we need, you go out and get it. Because we felt that without that information, their application was complete. We could frame the questions for the analytics, but we couldn't do the analytics without it. So in that case, the company said, okay, I will do that. There are other venues and avenues that we have. For instance, in Cape Wind, when we wanted to do something with regard to, I believe it was the long-tailed duck, we got together with Fish and Wildlife Service, the Mass Audubon, and we, BOEM, put in money to be able to gather some data that we knew was needed, so help us answer those questions and be able to do those things. So there are it depends on the type of information, the turnaround time. We have, as Algene talked to, this kind of long-term study program that we can use to gather baseline information, and also off of that, if there are certain nuances or questions found or gaps or needs identified through that study, we can use that to help fund issues. Does that necessarily help us when we're dealing with a particular project? No, but what it can help do is then inform either a question that we agree around the table needs to go back to the developer, or one that we can all partner to arrive at the data information. There is no set process. It really depends on when you need the information and the extent. If, let's say, they file their site assessment plan and we're taking a look at it and there's some information gaps that have to do with the construction operation phase, we can also take a couple tacks with that. We build into the regulatory frameworks some flexibility to use the tools that we know work. For instance, saying conditioning the lease or adding a lease stipulation that says, before you construct, you must gather data on these sorts of issues using these protocols that we've developed around the table. So before you commit to construction operation plan, we expect this data to be collected. That's one way. Another way that we've, another tool that we've folded into our regulatory framework is this monitoring. So let's say we discover that a particular type of seafloor is in this imposed area, and then we really want to understand, given that there's nothing there now, kind of follow its life through the life of this site assessment, construction operation, etc. We set up monitoring for that area, let's say because we're worried about burial during construction or whatever have you. We can make that a requirement right up front in the site assessment for the developer, either in with collaboration with other agencies that are interested or on its own. Gather that data, give it back to us here, and that can actually help inform the next phase of construction or just inform us just in generally speaking on baseline. So we have a lot of different opportunities available to us. writing a check and sending it to someone, that could be an option. Sometimes that's not the best option. I think the best tool comes when we around the table develop the understanding as to the protocols, to be able to gather the data, to be able to use the data in our NEPA documents, and then develop together, hopefully, the monitoring for that. To me, that's a protocol that I know that's worked in sand and gravel, and we're hoping to use it here. So we have various tools that we can use.
Hands are shooting up everywhere. I just want to ask Tim, is there a follow-up question after the answer?
No, I think that helps.
Okay.
In the back.
Arthur Spies, SHPO archaeologist. Does the site assessment work include the power line cables all the way to, for example, a substation connection? They have to come ashore somewhere. Where does your responsibility stop and somebody else's environmental review's responsibility take over?
That was the only part of the site assessment.
All the way up to
all the way to the
onshore and up to the substation.
Because our NEPA takes a look at not only just those areas that we have specific jurisdiction, but it takes a look at the environmental footprint of the whole project. So even though we're 3 miles out, we take a look at everything.
Thank you.
Hi, Kathleen Lane again. A two-part question. One is states are trying to encourage the development of renewables, and it's emerging as a national priority as well. Are there any incentives, Mo, you mentioned, in the Cape Wind situation of actually helping to finance a bird study, or are there any other incentives there for the environmental work that don't burden an emerging industry with a lot of requirements for that? And second is, how do you use an adaptive, or do you use adaptive management types of approaches to have monitoring after the lease, and then is there an opportunity to affect the lease that's been granted or the operations of the developer?
In fact, we did build in that adaptive management philosophy into our regulatory framework. We knew that we would be taking a look at emerging technology in areas that we didn't have a lot of environmental data. And so what we did was we have a provision that we can identify through our site assessment and construction operation plan review, identify certain, whether they're resources or certain activity that we would want to have monitored, and call that out. If the monitoring, let's say it was endangered species, let's say Fish and Wildlife Service says, okay, fine, you know, we can give you no jeopardy, but these are the things you must do, include developing a monitoring program, following these monitoring protocols, and give us the data. Let's say we engage in that, and we find out that it isn't as what we thought it was going to be. We had hoped that the requirements in place on the facility would result in a certain effect that it didn't. There are more birds being taken, let's say. What we can do under our rule, and with that lease, is say, stop. We've gathered this data that shows that things have changed. We need to reinitiate consultation with Fish and Wildlife Service, and we need to retool the operations and take a look at it. So we can do that. So we built that in there because we knew that we'd be operating in basically new frontier areas with regard to environmental information coupled with brand new technology that was constantly evolving. So we gave our ability to do that. So we kind of call that our adaptive management philosophy. It also could work the other way. Let's say we monitor for a particular effect on a particular resource, and we're getting really, really good results. It's even better than we thought it could be. Then we can actually take that lessons learned and apply it in the same area in analogous situations. And we say, hey, you know what? We don't have to ratchet down and become more rigorous. We're going to stay the course. This looks really good. So they get that feedback. So it's not data that goes into a black hole. It's data that actually helps inform the operator as well as future operations.
Any follow-up? Additional questions on the NEPA process and environmental review? I'll get you a second.
Jeff Murphy Davis. Could you please go back to the slide three? I'll just use the first competitive commercial as an example. For purposes of Section 7 consultation and the Endangered Species Act, it would give it your for instance, the lease sale, an SAP, and a COP, those are three things that you're separately authorizing. Do you consider that true, and are those three separate consultations for purposes of the Endangered Species Act?
What we've done with other resource agencies, so for example, up in Alaska, when we do oil and gas lease sales, we realize that this kind of framing in phased consultation can be burdensome. So what we've done is we have put together the lease sale EIS and the exploratory, or for our case, it would be the SAP consultations together, because we know that the site assessment activities are purely that. They're site assessment activities. They're doing the geophysical testing, the geotechnical testing, they're just gathering data. So that, to us, is a very reasonable way to couple it. We would work with Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries on that. And then we know where the rubber meets the road would be the construction operations plan, because that's where the specifics come. So we do have this kind of two-tier stage. But if a resource agency wanted to do all three, you know, that would work with us. But usually what makes sense, and once we get into this off of Maine, we can talk about how we want to stage this.
Okay, good, thanks. I do have one other question. In working with FERC with some of the tidal energy projects, what often happens is a disagreement concerning collection of baseline information. Origins feels that it's critical in order to do a robust environmental impact assessment to understand what's present there today, so that you can compare the effects to post-development. What's the OEM stance on baseline information?
I think we all have to take a look at what is being proposed, and we're using the best available information. And so I think one of the advantages of having kind of a phased approach where you have leasing and site assessment here and construction operation is that some of the baseline data that you need can be collected through that site assessment period and really inform that construction operation plan, even though, as Al Jean has on this slide here, that your EIS has to take a look at the activities that could be authorized by the lease. But you know that you have a more refined evaluation down, you know, scoping down to that construction operation plan at a later stage, so it can allow for both. I think the key thing, and this is why we have this dialogue around the table, is we can talk about those issues as to what's the information we have out there now, and what can that support and what it cannot support. And if those activities that it cannot support, is there a way that we can use desktop analytics or some analogous situations, knowing that when it comes to the construction operation plan, that could be 5 years, perhaps. With regard to the data, Tim talked about the site assessment period, where you're gathering that data. Take advantage of that time, whether it's the developer specifically gathering the data, or whether it's us as a task force, or BOEM using its scientific environmental studies program to collect that data, or just us just wanting to do something extra. We have that time period to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Questions. I think you mentioned that there were best management practices that were integrated into the lease. And what is the source of those, and are they standard for all leases, or do they vary depending on the each individual lease?
You can find a copy of those best management practices in the program or on the EIS.
Other questions? Is there any other discussion about the environmental review process, the lease process? Thank you, Karen Tilbert. Maybe I'll just throw an idea out that we can then think about for our discussion later under next action items for the next meeting. But it would seem with this group of agencies and state officials and tribal representatives that we might try to get a sense from each sector what the key questions are that they would be looking at under their respective statute. Should there be a proposal coming forth, say a SAP or a SAP and COP, site assessment plan and construction operation plan, I think it would certainly benefit the state agencies to have a better sense of
the specific kinds of data that the federal agencies might be looking at and wanting to see, and then the key questions and any especially issues that might be really put a halt on a project, for us to have a discussion around that. So I throw that out as something that we might talk about at our next meeting. Likewise, I think the state agencies would be happy to try to share how we would be doing that consistency analysis that we would be looking at to do for any project. So I just throw that out now and welcome any thoughts on that later today. Okay, any other questions or discussions on this topic? At this point in the program, we have agreed to take two questions from members of the public. And forgive me if I sound like a broken record, but we have folks that come in and go out, and I just need to make clear why this is limited to two questions. Normally, we only take questions from the public at the end of this process, the end of this meeting, because this is an intergovernmental agency meeting. So it's an opportunity for government representatives to have dialogue. So we're going to agree to take two questions right now. The remainder will be available. We've made time at 4 o'clock this afternoon for other questions. So I'm going to bring the microphone around to the side for the public, and we're going to start with you can just state your name for the panel. Thank you.
Ron Huber with Penobscot Baywatch. I had a NEPA question for you. It seems that with projects will be coming online at different times and configurations. I've seen that different states are at different paces on this. Yet you have a lot of migratory species, whether it's tuna or right whales or humpback whales or seabirds of different types that transit the whole coast. And so my NEPA question is, how will you coordinate these when you'll have a project in, say, in the Gulf of Maine that will have a minimal impact perhaps on tuna, and then the project turns out that's off South Carolina might have a minor but significant sort of impact on tuna. But that impact causes the one up in the Gulf of Maine to be, more significant than it would have been if the other one hadn't. How do you keep readjusting the sort of NEPA review? And I guess the way to ask that question, is it possible you'll do an entire coast-wide environmental impact study, or is it going to be sort of piecemeal region and region, state by state?
That is an excellent question, because that is one of the challenges of managing ocean energy development. It's the fact that the critters aren't bounded by mountains or passes or whatnot. That you do have this wonderful synergy, in the Gulf of Maine, as your example pointed out, to perhaps activity that could occur off of South Carolina, how that could affect fish stocks. That is going to be a challenge. I don't think there's one very simple answer to that question. NEPA does require that we do cumulative impact analysis, that we take a look at the project and we have an understanding of how it affects the specific environment that it's in, but also the issue associated with footprints. Algae had just a little bit of this list of resources that we take a look at. So when we would take a look at impacts to tuna, we just don't take a look at them on the exact project site. What we would do is, in the cumulative analysis, we take a look at what other planned or past activities are ongoing at the same time this project would be at its different phases, and doing the analytics to then say, and this is what the impact, cumulative impact of adding this particular project what the cumulative impact of this particular project would be to the tuna stocks. So we would take that into consideration. It becomes a very dynamic, and it's a challenge to do this kind of analytics, because then the next project that would come in Maine, or even perhaps off of Virginia, and how it could affect. But NEPA does give us that ability to inform the decision makers that even though they're making a decision on a specific project, that because of the cumulative impact assessment, that they have an understanding of how this accumulates or adds on to already existing stressors, you know, associated with the marine, human, and coastal environment.
I guess you'll have to ask the different agencies that are here, EPA for Region 1, will have to coordinate with the regions in the south and so on, with the other agencies too. These sort of task forces will have to interact with each other.
Absolutely, and that's kind of the beauty of having our task force system, because we can reach out and really quickly tap Tim Timmerman from EPA or his counterpart, you know, in the South Atlantic, let's say, you know, for Florida, as well as the beauty of having the folks sitting around the table. Because it's not one agency doing it alone. We have to really be able to mine the data sets and the experience from the other federal agencies, state agencies, local elected officials, as well as the tribal governments, because there's traditional knowledge there that can also help inform impact to resources.
And the second question.
I don't know if I can exercise government or not. My name is Stacy Fitz. I'm a state representative and also was on the Ocean Energy Task Force, but I'm here today as a citizen. And that's complicated. You don't need to get into that. My question is, in trying to understand the first set of flow charts that described what I made the note, one NEPA document, and then comparing that to the last side-by-side of the competitive, non-competitive, and limited, I see potentially in the competitive vein, three NEPA documents. And trying to get a handle on how that is managed by a potential developer in the risk assessment, because a lot of effort and money and time is put into creating that NEPA document with no guarantee that later on they could be determined to be a competitive environment and lose the opportunity after spending a considerable effort. So from the development world, it's just kind of a convoluted view of the decision-making process. And is there opportunity for compressing that? I heard that it can be compressed, but under what mechanisms is it compressed and how is that done?
I would hope that, you know, after we have this dialogue, it won't be so convoluted, because sometimes it's even confusing to me. And this is, I think, the challenge of this particular energy sector, is that you're talking about some great ideas to address some really key energy issues, and yet, you know, we don't have the data. We have a host of environmental laws that we must comply with. Let me say this first, that with regard to your no guarantee issue, EPAC does require us to issue leases on a competitive basis, as Tim said, unless the Secretary determines after public knows that there is no competitive interest. Let's remember that, and then let me give you an example. So you have an unsolicited request come in to BOEM, and we engage the task force and we're going down that process. Once we engage that unsolicited proposal and we go out to determine if there's competitive interest and none is found, there is no risk that someone else is going to come in again and try to challenge that. I think Tim pointed that out too in his presentation, that once we engage on a non-competitive process, it is that process. So there, at least there's that guarantee that no one can then come in after you and try to steal that away. So that's just with regard to non-competitive. But you're correct, there are these opportunities for all these different NEPA documentations. Tim also mentioned, I think Algene did as well in her presentation, that the number of NEPA compliance places is really going to be determined dependent on the information that is brought to the table. So for example, for a competitive lease sale, that is something that our agency owns. There's no one benefactor for that. It is multiple entities are interested in leasing in this particular area. We will do that NEPA documentation. So fortunately, in that case, a developer isn't putting up the money nor the time nor the effort for that particular competition EIS. So then we issue the lease. Then they have a choice. There is time that elapses during the EIS process. You heard Al Jean talk about the requirements for public scoping, and for the draft hearings, those take time. So the issue then is a developer can come to the table after the lease is issued, and the more robust information it has to address those requirements we have published back in 09, April of 09, to file a construction operation plan, they can short circuit one of those stops and say, I want to file with you, BOMA, a combined construction operation plan with a site assessment plan. Here's my information. We still have to, that is a major federal action, there's no waiver of NEPA, but we have to go through those analytics, and we all want to do that because, again, this is a new energy sector, generally speaking, in an environment that we don't have a lot of information. So then you only have two NEPA. For a non-competitive process, we learned from the sand and gravel program, and we found that to go through with the process of having, there's no competitive leasing for sand and gravel, first of all, it just doesn't happen that way. So we thought instead of doing a separate lease issuance that's not competitive and then evaluating their plan to actually extract the sand, what we decided to do is hold off on issuing the lease, yet we will not allow another company to come in non-competitive after we determine non-competitive. So we'll do the NEPA, prepare the NEPA work on the lease and the site assessment phases. Again, the same thing could hold, that I, as a developer, I've gathered enough information to actually complete a filing for a construction operation plan. So even under the non-competitive scenario, there might just be one environmental assessment done. If I have robust enough information to meet the regulatory needs that we have outlined in subpart F for construction operation plan. So I think there are ways to be more efficient. But I think the bottom line is we have, and Al Jean's presentation I think really brought it home, all those federal agencies that have all these jurisdictions associated with ocean activities that we must somehow be able to be on the correct side of the law and comply with. And NEPA is one of the tools that we can be most efficient on, hopefully to do the right kind of analytics to help those other federal agencies with their decision making so we don't duplicate. So there are ways that we can be more efficient and yet meet the laws that we need. Thank you.